Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Australian Wolverine.
Hello?
Was he just talking through that whole thing?
Did I just hear Australian Wolverine?
Yes.
Are we talking Spider-Man and his amazing friends, Australian Wolverine? Or?
Stop moving around, damn it. X-Men Pride of the X-Men was released in 1989 and looked like it had been kept in storage for 15 years. It was the last stand of Stan Lee standing around and talking at each other era of X-Men cartoons.
Yeah.
I have it on VHS. It's good. I like it.
I've got it too. My two favorite things are, Nothing Moves the Blob and, when Cyclops opens his mouth and Duke's voice comes out. That's, fantastic.
There were a lot of G.I. Joe voice actors who did voices on that. Yeah.
Nostalgia Critic did a whole thing on it too. He said it stood up. It was pretty good. He liked it.
Nothing Moves the Blob.
There it is. Yeah, it was the, they used that cast for the, stand up, coin op video game too. The same main six, Dazzler and, was it Children of the Atom? Was that it? Was that the name of it?
Yes.
Did I win?
That was a coin op.
Ooh, number three is Teen Prostitute Wolverine. I think I'll pass that one.
What?
All right, I'm gonna stop you guys right there. So
before John destroys my childhood any further.
For those who haven't figured it out, you're listening to Superhero Speak. I'm your host, Dave.
Oh, and John. Hi.
We've started.
Correct.
Yes, we're just gonna start. I'm gonna keep that in because it was funny. and this week we have a returning guest with us. One of the first, well, not the first returning guest, but one of the first guests who actually requested to come back on fairly quickly. So it makes me wonder what's wrong with them. So everyone, welcome Troy Brownfield back.
He's really into S&M.
Champion.
How are you doing, Troy?
I will take Dark Secrets for 200, David.
The answer is Christian Grey.
I'm doing well. Oh, there you go.
Dave will take Things Only He Knows for 800.
So before we get into it, if you remember from last time, we do our Geek of the Week, our Stump the Geek question.
Yes.
So first I'll ask you, this was last week's question. See if you know the answer to it. Everyone just recently saw Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm sure.
Yes.
And Rocket Raccoon was featured in the movie, of course. And in the comic books, he has a quote-unquote catchphrase that he uses before he shoots people, or as he shoots people, which was not featured in the movie. What was that catchphrase?
Catch lead, motherfucker.
I don't know.
Right in the family jewels? I mean, he's at the right height when he shoots, so.
That's the same joke you made last week, John.
I know.
Is this to me, then?
Yes.
Murdered you.
Yes!
Really?
Yes, he says, blam, murdered you.
Nice.
But we did have a listener who got the right answer.
Excellent.
So, Ryan Nadler, you are our Geek of the Week. Congratulations.
And not at all dangerous.
So this week's question, right before we got on, John found this very strange fact.
I am the crack research team.
You just gave them a hint where they could find the answer. So it was an article about the most bizarre comic book crossovers, and I thought this was the most bizarre. Marvel had a crossover with a daytime soap. So the question is, name the soap and the two characters from Marvel that crossed over with it. So that's the question for the week, everyone.
I know the first half of this.
I'm scared. I had never heard of this.
I told you we'd have fans.
I know the show. I don't know which characters, but okay. I know which show it was. It's cheating because I was with Newsarama at the time.
Getting
the press release and needing oxygen because I was laughing so hard. And then, but yeah, so.
So Troy.
Yes, sir.
Did you write any good books lately?
That remains to be seen, guys.
Okay.
No. I like to think so. You know, it's interesting because one of the things that we talked about, last time, one of the things I talked to David, you know, we talked a long time. We talked about a lot of different things, but, I said this, kind of off the clock, as it were, that I felt like, you know, I had a great time and everything, but, I felt that since I was really kind of on Zenoscope's dime, so to speak, that, that it wasn't fair to talk about other stuff that right. was going on. And, and also there were a couple of things that weren't cleared yet to really discuss that were, going on. So, you know, I said, hey, if you guys are ever interested in having me back, you know, I'd love to talk about these other things. Cause, you know, at the time I felt like, you know, dance with the one that brought you, so to speak. And while I'd be happy to talk about Zenoscope stuff because we're in the middle of Grim Fairy Tales versus Wonderland right now as a mini. Since that time, Blood Queen got going for Dynamite that I write, and the Prince Dracula novel started getting publicized, which I also wrote for Dynamite. And then there's the two webcomics that I do, Spark Shooter and Solo Acoustic, which we kind of touched on but didn't really get much into. So there's like a whole lot of stuff that's actually happening all at once. That's which is a good thing. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if someone says, we'd like you to take part in this interview on our behalf, I really feel bad if I suddenly say, and then I'm doing this because
right.
you know, I have a modicum of, I don't even know if I'm going to say class, respect. I respect Joe and Ralph and what they've done for me. So I feel like, you know.
Right, right. Yes. And we just had Pat on the show and he talked intensely for hours about, you know, Zenoscope. So we can put them in the back burner for this week. So Dynamite, Blood Queen.
Yes.
I have not read the book yet, but I've heard a lot of good things about it. Why don't you tell the folks listening a little bit about it?
Well, let's see. Issue 4 and the annual will be coming out, in September.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's funny because Blood Queen and Prince Dracula developed right around the same time, for me. Basically what we had was a situation where, I was, talking to Dynamite about doing some things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this, notion of the novel was going on. And, you know, this wasn't a new thing for Dynamite because they've got like the SEAL Team 6 series that Chuck Dixon wrote and wrote 6 books in that series. And I mean, novels, they started out as ebooks and they've been in print. First novel sold over 100,000 copies. Mm. There's a spinoff of that series as well. And so they're kind of looking to branch out. So they're talking to some people about some different things. And, you know, I'm kind of a horror guy in some respects. And, you know, I had some talks about, they had an idea that they wanted to do something kind of in that direction. And they had more of an idea than I knew at first. So it was kind of unveiled to me slowly, which was cool. and, you know, it's like, hey, we did a horror thing. I'm like, oh, I can do horror things. It's like, well, I mean, it's going to be a vampire thing. Well, that's cool. How about like a Dracula thing? And I'm like, okay. Now, I didn't know really how much I wanted to kind of write a Dracula novel until I was in the process, you know, and it wasn't something that I ever sat around and thought, well, hey, I really want to do a Dracula book. And then, once it started coming up and rolling, I'm thinking, you know, I started thinking of things like associations I had going back to when I was a kid, you know, like Hammer, you know,
right.
Hammer kind of Dracula and this, cause they had talked about, you know, doing it from Mina's point of view and maybe, you know, doing action and doing scary stuff, but also, playing up, you know, some of that erotic content. And that to me just says Hammer. And, you know, growing up with like Horror of Dracula and, you know, Prince Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Satanic Rites of Dracula and all that stuff. You know, they were really just plain to me.
Yeah, right.
Spent many a Saturday afternoon watching Hammer films and getting the crap scared out of me and strangely excited at the same time.
Yes. Yes. God bless Ingrid Pitt.
Yeah, they did have some very, very, nice curvy women.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny because we'll get back to Ingrid Pitt in a minute. But, when that started coming up, at the same time as that was going on, Hannah, Gorfinkel, now Hannah Elder, she got married in between there. Congratulations, Hannah. She said that, you know, Molly Mahan, who's a assistant editor at Dynamite, was also developing a book that I might be right for. And, they had an idea of doing a book that was, connected, you know, some way, kind of halfway between like Elizabeth Bathory and halfway between, kind of the dark queens of fairy tales, you know, which clearly fits my resume. But then, you know, again, I'm already in this Hammer mindset and it's like, I hear Elizabeth Bathory and I'm like, Countess Dracula, Ingrid Pitt, Carolyn Monroe. It's like, yeah, you know, I know what you're talking about. And, so this became a thing. We're looking at that and I'm like, okay, well, where does the Wicked Queen archetype come from? And what if we combined that with this Elizabeth Bathory, kind of background, throw in a little bit of Game of Thrones style kingdom intrigue. And, you know, Blood Queen came together really fast for me. And, you know, fortunately they liked it. They liked the idea, that I had for doing a Dracula book and the concept and the pitch of what became Prince Dracula and then Blood Queen. And that was all going on at the same time. And it was terrifying because, you know, when you go through these pitches and these cycles of trying to get this, work started and this work generated, you know, I've kind of, you want to be excited because you want to be excited for the work. You want that enthusiasm to carry into what you're doing. But at the same time, you kind of punish yourself if you get too excited for something that doesn't happen. Right. And, you know, that's happened plenty of times.
And having that horror background too, I mean, it just must have been exciting to have something like that kind of come to you and, you know, have the opportunity to be able to do the background of Elizabeth Bathory kind of, you know,
yeah.
It's really exciting.
Yeah. And, you know, it's also in a way, it doesn't, not 100%, you know, maybe the full 90%, but it does, kind of make up for some of the fact that there were things that I would have loved to have done with Fangoria that weren't able to happen because of that crash and burn we talked about last time. Right. You know, literally, you know, there's two whole miniseries I wrote that will never come out. Oh. And, you know, and that's the thing, you know, sometimes those things happen for legal reasons and all those things, but you know, that's, you know, as Douglas Adams said, that's a very long, dark tea time of the soul. do with that kind of thing, going on. So in a way, I felt like a little bit of a measure of it. And, you know, honestly, today, because when Prince Dracula started, it was, available on Amazon, you know, first as Kindle and so forth. Right. And then it moved in paperback. And, you know, I got my boxes of my, print copies today. And, that's an incredible feeling to have this book, you know, and like my wife looked at it and she's like, wow, it's big. And, you know, I'm just like, because, you know, inside.
Is that what she said?
Yeah. But yeah, seriously, it was kind of unbelievable to actually look at it.
Is that the first book you've had published that wasn't a comic book?
Yeah. Okay. First novel. Yeah. I've done, lots and lots of, magazine articles, newspaper articles,
right.
Like literally like thousands of online things between Newsarama and all that. But, yeah, first novel, and that's a real good feeling.
Something you can take back to the old English teacher and say, see, I can do it.
Oh, yeah.
Shot of, from Back to the Future in my head when he gets those novels and the books at the end and he finally opens them up.
Yes. Yes. God, what is that called? So like a match made in space or something like that.
Yeah, it's got like Robbie the Robot on the front.
Yep. but yeah, it's, I tell you the truth, you know, with the exception of, a couple of teachers here and there, I had a lot of supportive people. And, ironically, there's one creative writing prof that I joke about a lot. Who's unfortunately passed away, but he was a huge influence. The guy I would have loved to have shared this with. But you know, I had him from the time I was a freshman in college, and he was like the very definition of the word character. You know, his name was Howard McMillan, and he was a huge influence, just a really incisive, critic and a complete mess in all these other aspects, which was awesome. and this incredibly weird, deep voice that, you know, he'd read stories. One of my best friends, Terry McCammon, and I were in the creative writing class together, and Howard was always trying to make me explain Terry's stories. So it was like, well, we read Terry's story this week. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Troy, explain it to me.
give me the Cliff Notes, Troy.
I could have been hungover. Well, and then, you know, like a year later, my wife is 1 year younger than me. And Howard, in addition to his creative writing, taught freshman English. And so my wife was one of his freshman English students. And he always made a big deal that, you know, he was really tough on him. He only gave one or two A's and everything. And then when he found out that Becky and I were dating, he says, you're dating
Becky? God damn, she's way too smart for you. I don't know what she sees at all. That's ridiculous. I'm like, you know, she got an A for me. I only gave two A's last semester.
I'm like, yeah, Howard, I know you only give two.
Yeah, anyway, she got one. So she's real smart. She has some kind of problem because I know you. I know you. You're all messed up.
You know, and it was – so, yeah. So, but, yeah. But honestly, you know, he's the kind of guy that he would give you a paperback, you know, if you wrote a short story, and he would have – good Lord, 110 notes on it, you know, and like 70 of them might be positive. But the guy just found something. He wrote, you know, he was encouraging on a ridiculous number of levels. And like everything I learned from that guy, I applied to teaching and so forth. And then to get to this level, you know, I think Howard's one of the people who really would have thought that, you know, it was something I could do. And so, you know, there's a big part of me that says, you know, thanks to that guy, even though he's not around. So I can just still do Howard's voice. Regale people with it.
Yeah, no. Yeah,
my wife's always crazy. Crazy.
It's great to have, definitely great to have people like that in your life, that influence you and guide you through things like that. Even if they do criticize you to your wife.
it was good natured. You know, he was really big supporter. I remember the very first meeting we had at Literary Magazine, when I was a freshman. You know, I was one of those kids that I have a September birthday. So, I was younger because they changed the dates after I started school. So I was 17, like the first 2 weeks of college.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd signed up for this stuff, and we go to this pizza place across from the campus where there's going to be a reading. And my friend Terry and I are sitting at the table with Howard. He's like, hey, so how old are you guys? We're like, 17. He's like, 21. Like, what? He's like, we're getting a picture. You're 21. people come out. It's like, the waitress comes up. I'm like, here I am. Like, we're going to get carded. We're so going to get carded. It's like, hey, I need four glasses and a pitcher. And they're like, okay. You know, and I'm like, what? That's not supposed to work like that. You know, yeah. Exactly. Nice. It was the best for you. No, it was. But, you know, when you talk about formative experiences and environments, you know, I run into a lot of people who have kind of the same that are in my age group. You know, I'm 40. I'll be 41 here in a few days. I run into a lot
21.
Of people. You know, I have this formative experience for people from my age group, you know, where there were kids in grade school in the late 70s and early 80s, where there were teachers who were very against comics and very against, you know, genre material, and very discouraging on that level toward it. And so it made it, there's almost an ethos about it where, you know, you felt like you were really pushing back against that by being even more into it.
Well, they would have been all raised on that whole Seduction of the Innocent era, like having that view that comics are, you know, the cause of a whole bunch of mental issues. And so I could see how they would, the older generation would have had that kind of view and kind of like not pushed you towards it, but.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the best and worst things was like when my, fifth grade year, we had a situation where it was like, we did personal writing. So we got to write like stories and stuff every week, and anything that strayed too far in genre, I kind of got like, you know, whacked with rolled up newspaper for. And, it really, really kind of made me resentful of that dude. But now I get tremendous satisfaction out of, you know, wow, that guy would have hated this stuff. And, you know, and my kids, you know, my oldest son is in fourth grade. So I'm like, here, read this. Check this out.
I'd write papers and then get sent down to the principal's office for it.
So we found this thing in your son's backpack, and it's called Watchmen. No.
Right.
Oh, God.
No, actually, my wife and I, we're pretty, supportive of whatever the kids and, you know, investigate, but at the same time, we read enough stuff to kind of, you know, slowly roll out what's
right,
what's appropriate. So Connor's, yeah, he was just, getting into, the Armor Wars era of Iron Man and really kind of
nice
checking that out. And, you know, so, you know, he's 9, so he's kind of a great age for it and seeing it in the movies and whatnot, you know.
And when he gets old enough, you can disappoint him with the Clone Saga.
Yeah.
You don't want to put him completely off, dude.
Well, it is really funny because Connor, you know, DK Publishing does all of those, character encyclopedias and things. And, Connor, is pretty, you know, Kyle does it too, but Connor is really into reading the character encyclopedias. And I've never seen a 9-year-old complain so bitterly about the New 52. You know, and he's just like, he was reading something one day and he was just shaking his head and sighing. I'm like, what are you reading? And he's like, holds up and it's the DK, New Superman book with the stuff on all the Superman titles at the end. He's just like, man, I don't even know where to start with this. I'm like, wow, my little jaded
on the internet.
Yep. It's just really funny. And like some of his comments on that score are just really crazy. You know, to like every once in a while, he'll read something and he's like, he'll point something out to his brother. Like Kyle will ask a question and he'll say, you know, sometimes you just have to ignore some of this stuff because they all ignore it 6 months later anyway. I'm like, wow.
It's called retcon
of disbelief.
It's called retcon.
It's like, just don't worry about it. Like, you know, very funny. So
it's funny to hear a 9-year-old seeing that already.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was one of the great moments of, you know, you guys mentioned Guardians of the Galaxy up top.
Right.
And just, you know, I don't know that there were any kids in the theater, besides mine that were really excited to see Cosmo. Yeah.
Everybody's like, who?
Yeah, exactly.
Russian dog, like, dad, come on. Yeah,
you know, and Ed Howard the Duck, you know, that was, it was hysterically funny, you know, just to see them. Connor is one of the best people on earth to watch a superhero related movie with, because you think, you know, I'm asthmatic, so I can make this joke, but, you often think that Connor might be having an asthma attack from all the short, sharp gasps during, you know, Winter Soldier's like that, you know, every little Easter egg, like when, you know, on the rooftop when they mentioned Stephen Strange, I thought Connor was going to pass out.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like, calm down, dude. It's okay. It's like,
so the apple doesn't fall far from the tree?
No, not a bit.
It's funny because I do the same thing with my wife.
She's a Stephen Strange fan.
Yeah. Oh my God, Stephen Strange!
All right, so to get a little bit back onto, on track.
Were we off track? I didn't.
There was a track.
There's a track. Yeah.
with Prince Dracula. So I guess my question around that, just in general, is, you know, we just had the wonderful Twilight series, and remember I told you last time you were on, you can do whatever you want with vampires as long as they don't sparkle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you find it a challenge to, you know, now that, you know, vampires and zombies are flooding the popular, market, as it were, did you find it a challenge to bring a new aspect to, you know, Dracula, or what was your take on it? How's that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. That's, it's something you kind of simultaneously, you do and you don't think about. Like, you have to balance it a little bit. You don't want to do anything that's directly aping anything. You know, I had the advantage of having an incredibly strong piece of source material to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you're thinking about it, it's like, okay, I rationalize this in the fact that Dracula is one of the most adapted things ever. You know, stage plays, spinoff novels, you know, Fred Saberhagen's books.
Breakfast cereals.
Yeah. and you know, I also had the advantage of, you know, the show on NBC, the recent Dracula series kind of deeply amused me. You know, Dracula as Nikola Tesla.
I kind of dug that.
Well, I like that idea, you know, but it's like my main thing was like, why does Dracula want to give people electric light?
You want to put the oil tycoons out of business.
Yeah. But you know, the vampire is in the business of lights. You know, I liked that. The whole thing of, there's all these interpretations, you know, and everybody's got their favorites. The first thing was kind of like going back to the book, this idea of, telling things kind of from Mina's point of view. So there's an element of it where I wanted to incorporate things. So it's like that it kind of parallels the book to a certain point and then kind of branches off radically. And it does. There's like very certain parallels. I also wanted to, you know, the original novel, it's all epistolary. So we have everything, all the action is conveyed in diary entries, letters, Dr. Seward's awesomely crazy phonograph diary, which I love, just the idea of that. You know, we've got to put this on wax and turn the crank so I can record my notes. I love that. But at the same time, it's like, okay, that prevents an element of suspense in the action that's happening. Because to me, if you have a character that's writing the description of an encounter of something, then you know that character made it long enough to write that out. Right. So I thought, okay, well, we're going to shift this to a third person kind of thing. But, I want to do the various points of views, so we'll just tell it from various points of views. And within that aspect, I wanted to use points of views that weren't touched on. So I ended up playing up Quincy Morris more, because I think he's an awesomely weird character. He's the Texas cowboy,
right,
in the middle of all of these very proper British characters. And I liked that. I liked the contrast of it. And you kind of know historically where it's coming from because, you know, Stoker's writing the book. It's about 1893. He sets the action in 1893. And, like, Buffalo Bill's Wild West show was hugely popular in Europe. Mm-hmm. So the cowboy was actually a really, you know, well-known, embraced archetype. You know, it's kind of like the late 90s American fad of Hong Kong movies. Mm-hmm. And in this late 1800s phase in England, you know, there was a lot of interest in, you know, the American West. So Quincy Morris already comes off as kind of like a mythic character. And then when you read the books, he's the first guy that's not Van Helsing to understand what they're talking about when they say vampires, because he's encountered the vampire bats in South America. And so, like, really getting deep into the book, and I'm like, man, there's all this stuff that you can pull out and do interesting things with as far as the characters. But then, you know, I threw in some hammer twists and, you know, without going too far out of the range of giving things away, there were lots of other vampires in literature in the late 1800s, too.
Nice.
And they're all in public domain.
So, two greatest words in the English language.
Yes, yes. What Alan Moore hath given. But seriously, you know, it was one of those things where they were enormously supportive and encouraging, because I have this habit, and, you know, Matt Brady and I joke about this. It's like, they always tell you, you know, not to pitch, you know, it's like, I have a Fantastic Four story. It's 12 parts and it has Galactus in it. And they always tell you, you know, it's like, well, pitch what the Fantastic Four did for lunch, and then maybe we'll talk about it. And you know what I mean, where it's like they want you to pitch small. And so Matt and I always joke that we have like the multi-level pitch. It's like, let's do what they did for lunch, and then the next 12 years, so that we've got it ready to go. And, you know, when we were going back and forth, and I had said some ideas to Hannah, and, you know, here I kind of want to do this and this and this, and Hannah said, one of the most beautiful sentences that an editor can say to you, you know, you can go bigger.
Oh,
and I'm like, oh, free reign. You're kidding, right? Because like, I'm like, you just really don't want to hear bigger. and she's like, no, go ahead. I started, you know, going off on tangents, and they dug the tangents. I got to do some crazy stuff. And I think it's fair to say that if this continues to do well, there's already a model in Dynamite's book publishing with SEAL Team 6 that there can be others. So,
like SEAL Team 6 versus a vampire?
Well, no, as in like a second book. But, you know, right. Now that you said that,
oh, no.
Do you guys watch The Strain by any chance?
Oh, I am loving The Strain right now.
Okay, so the most recent episode, they introduced Mr. Quinlan, although they haven't named him yet. Like, if you've read the books, then that's but yeah, what a great character introduction that was.
that was really good. I haven't picked up the books. I was going to go back and start checking them out and everything too, but I love the direction that it's going. The slow burn of that infectious, almost a monstrous infection taking over New York. I'm really loving the direction of that.
Yeah, and what's kind of great about that too is that it, you know, from where I sit, and I mean, having read the books and really enjoying those, You know, one of the things that was in Dracula's plan in the original novel was that he had access to London and, as they say, it's teeming millions. And, you know, I always liked the idea that one of the reasons to relocate to London was that there was lots of available food.
Right.
And, but, you know, I also tried to incorporate this idea of Dracula as patriot, which they hit on early in the novel. And this is where the Prince Dracula title comes from, you know, where Dracula's talking to Jonathan Harker and he gets really up on the horse about defending Transylvania and Romania from the Turks. And that, you know, he's got the blood of Attila and, you know, he's the Prince of Wallachia and he is not going to stomach these invaders. And I always thought about that, like, as an interesting point of view. It's like, okay, well, he's got this feeling and then he goes to London ostensibly to hunt, but he's kind of leaving the homeland behind. And so in my mind, it became a question of kind of reconciling those motivations and like, okay, what if in Dracula's mind, he is actually going to London as an extension of this mission? Because if you're a royal or if you've been around a while in Europe in the late 1800s, you get the idea that World War One is just around the corner.
Mm.
You know, that Europe is a powder keg by that point. And in 20 years, it's going to blow.
So it was almost looking as him extending his empire almost by moving to London.
Yeah. So there's some thoughts in that direction. So all these things kind of played into my mind is like, you know, and they're answering questions that, you know, I'm less, you know, Stoker's got a different set of concerns, obviously. I mean, Stoker was Irish born and living in London, which, you know, obviously presents some unique feelings and challenges.
Right.
And, you know, I'm looking at it from in view. I'm really interested in kind of like this, what Stephen King refers to is as the Dionysian incursion, like in Danse Macabre, his first nonfiction book about the horror genre. He talks about the idea that, you know, the regular reality is Apollonian. Okay. The idea that, you know, you have light and reason and then horror is really Dionysus. It's the upset of light and reason. And at the end of the book, you either restore the Apollonian reality or you fall into the Dionysian reality. And he's like, nothing represents this so much as Dracula, where you have Dracula staked at sunrise in the original novel. And then, you know, fast forward to Mina and Jonathan have their baby and everybody's fine. And, you know, Harry's scar is gone and everything. But, you know, you've got that whole kind of thing. It's like we've reconciled this. So looking at that, I started to get really interested in the idea that with women in the Victorian era, that women figuring out that they were strong and capable and smart and gifted in science and all of these different things that had been kept from them, that women were also a Dionysian incursion to the men. So you have this kind of upheaval where they're just as scared of Mina and Lucy in some respects as they are of things that go bump in the night. You're going to be able to off the vampire with a stake. You're not going to be able to off the women's movement.
Right.
Yeah. Like, and it was kind of a very changing kind of environment for them at that point. You know, they kind of had to adapt or die.
Yeah. Well, and this is, I'll say this, you know, like, you know, trying like shying away from some of the spoilers, but, Mina is a teacher, you know, in the original novel.
Right.
And so I decided to kind of move her towards science, which I understand that the NBC series moved her toward medicine. But, at the beginning of the book, I have her coming back from France. She studied with the same guy that taught Marie Curie. And, so I was kind of playing with that a little bit. This was a time that women were really, expanding and coming up in a new way. And so I thought that was cool because then you get this friction between Jonathan, who's a lawyer, and Dracula, who's, you know, if you don't know that Dracula's a vampire, he's still going to be pretty suave dude, right? You know, he's got – like Gary Oldman played him in the Coppola movie. He's the fancy –
Gary Oldman.
Yeah. Yeah. Gary – yeah. Which, you know, that's one of the great interviews I got to do when I was working for Newsarama is like on the Dark Knight set. We got to interview Gary Oldman. And it was a really weird thing because it's like my thought was like, what's he really sound like? Because we hear Gary Oldman in Movie Without Number and it's not his accent ever.
Right.
And so like, that was what I was kind of consumed with, and I think it was, Andy Corey from Comics Alliance now and Ricky Purden, who was at Wizard, who's now at DC, and Alan Kistler and a couple of guys, Rick Marshall from MTV, like a bunch of us were sitting around this room waiting for Oldman to come in, and somebody says, you know, what does Gary Oldman say when he walks in a room? And I said, nah, you thought it was White Boy Day. And so we all crack up, and then Oldman walks in the room, and he's like, oh, what's so funny? And we're like, shh. Like, then you have, we're quoting Drexel the Killer Pimp. You know, it's just, but, so yes.
Half an hour later, yes. The answer is yes.
I love that whole concept of the novel. I can't wait to check that out, honestly.
Thanks. Thank you guys. Yes, I'm a rambler. I know.
So when does Mina become part of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Some point after.
Page though.
Yeah.
Right after the events of Penny Dreadful.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was making jokes about that too. I'm like, yeah, I was joking at one point that it's like we need to make these newspaper references to every member of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen being killed.
Right.
That'd be awesome.
It's like explorer Alan Quartermain lost in Africa. you know, and I'm like, nah, I just don't want to poke that bear.
Yeah.
But you know, it's
whatever you do would be better than the movie.
Yeah, well, you know, all due respect to Moore, like, he wasn't the first guy to reinvent Dracula. He's not going to be the last guy, you know. Right, I'm not the last guy this week.
Right.
So, true.
You know, they've got this whole Dracula Unbound thing coming up where whatever it is. Is it Reborn? Hell, I don't know. The new universe movie. I haven't even seen the trailer for it, but I hear that, like, we're going to have a shared universe of Universal Monsters. I'm like, you guys were the first shared universe to begin with.
Yeah.
Right.
House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, you know, followed, of course, by the Godzilla universe.
Abbott Costello meet the Wolfman.
Exactly. Yeah. Abbott Costello meet Frankenstein is that is a tremendous comedy. I know we joke about, joke so much about the fact that, you know, Abbott and Costello meeting the monsters kind of killed their effectiveness as scary monsters. But the one where, you know, meet Frankenstein and Scott Lugosi and Lon Chaney in it is tremendously funny.
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And especially there's the scene where Lon Chaney Jr. is trying to convince them that he's a danger, that he's like, you know, when the full moon comes out, I turn into a wolf. And Costello's answer is you and about a million other guys. Like, that is good. That is classic.
It's timeless comedy.
Yeah. That's good stuff. And Vincent Price is the voice of the Invisible Man. You know, that's
the same way you kind of had the same thing happen with like newer horror characters like Freddy Krueger. Like he got to the point where almost the movies were comedy at some point.
Yeah.
But then somebody else takes it, somebody else reimagines it, and somebody else, you know, makes it their own and brings the horror back into it. You know, that's kind of seems like how the cycle goes on that stuff. But me and my wife always talk, like, we're big horror fans. It almost seems like we're in, like, almost the third gothic movement now with, like, a lot of these, you know, reimaginings of the classic tales, just how pervasive it is in pop culture and everything too.
Yeah.
And as a horror fan, it's like a great time to have all these resources and all these things to enjoy, you know.
So what you're saying is it's just a countdown to the next Blackula, right? It's just a countdown until they decide to reimagine that, and then wait for the next start.
If history is any indication, we would see that again. Yeah,
there is some dude ready to make that.
I know,
like, right now. I'm sure. You know, somebody, some guy is that's on his list. You know, like
probably the
else.
Same guy who put Howard the Duck at the end of the Guardians movie.
Wesley Snipes is Blackula.
Oh God!
Actually, I've been working on a script for, you know, a couple months now. John, don't want to ruin it.
So I think you were a fan of Howard showing up.
No.
I did myself.
I kind of looked at it as taking one back. I don't think that they'll do anything with it, but it was kind of like, and now we reclaim Howard.
it's true, because they could never show him in the movie that they made, and the comic books, they could never show him like he was originally designed, because Disney had sued them because they owned Donald Duck, and they said the design was too close. So
put your pants on.
Yeah.
Well, and they did that whole mini in late 90s, early 2000s, where Gerber came back and did Howard Got Turned Into a Mouse, like his reaction to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it is so funny that, you know, And there was still, I had a student in class not too long ago that was raging about, you know, oh, like Disney is going to ruin Star Wars. I'm like, dude, Disney saved Star Wars.
Yeah.
Or like, are you kidding? It's like, have you seen Avengers? It's like, I'm sorry. Disney owned Miramax when they made Pulp Fiction. You know, I really didn't get the sense that Disney had too much of a hand in that.
Yeah.
There was like, a lot of Miramax movies that came out during that time. You're like, really? Disney's the parent company on this?
Yeah. Priest.
Priest was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah. Yes.
Actually.
Can you imagine Pulp Fiction starring Goofy and Mickey Mouse?
I could totally imagine that.
I'm sure somebody's written that one too. Quarter pounder
with cheese in France, Mickey? What, Goofy? Royale with cheese, Mickey? Yeah, I can totally see that.
See?
I would watch the hell out of that movie. The wolf would actually be
move,
the wolf would actually be the wolf from Three Little Pigs.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Talk about writing something right now. Make that happen.
Yeah, next season on Once Upon a Time, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And because it's satire, it's completely legal to use the characters.
That's right.
There you go.
I'm thinking about this. Now I'm sitting here going, like,
is that? That's a good idea. I like that.
Anyway,
Pete would be Zed, right?
Oh, yeah.
Bring out the gimp. Yeah. Wow. There's people listening to this that are scarred forever now.
Yes.
Pepe Le Pew is revealed as the gimp.
Eat me just a little bit harder.
Oh my god.
I think someone's going to hell for this conversation.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway.
Speaking of writing. Somewhere around here, right? No.
Yes. What's that?
Speaking of writing, Troy.
Yes, sir.
As you're writing, you know, Blood Queen and Prince Dracula, is there ever a temptation to cross them over in some way?
You know, it's funny because Dynamite just announced this thing that Gail Simone is writing, mm-hmm. that Women of Dynamite crossover with Red Sonja and so forth. And right. I'm not really privy to what's going on with it. I know that they've got you know, Red Sonja and Vampirella and Deja, and like the three of them will cross paths, and they're talking about like all these different female characters. And there's like part of me going like, direct message Gail. Yeah, like take Blood Queen, run, go, you know. But I haven't. And it's like, you know, and if they do, I mean, that'd be awesome. It would be really, really cool. You know, it's really cool to the idea of having originated a character and have someone else work with it too. Which you get a little bit of in the annual. The annual's two stories. The lead is written by me and it's primarily drawn by Fritz Cassis, who's the regular series artist, which is kind of unusual. You don't usually get the regular series artist to draw the annual too.
Right.
But then the second story is written by Dan Wickline, who I've worked with at Zenoscope and who's done some other stuff for Dynamite here and there. But, you know, we talked a little bit about what that story would be so that it kind of fit in with everything. And, like, my only, I don't know, stipulation was that it had to be named after a Slayer song. Because that is my naming convention. The first arc was named Rain and Blood, and subsequent arcs would be named after Slayer albums, but individual stories would be named after individual songs. So like the lead story of the annual is Ghosts of War, which is a single. And that just kind of went to this whole thing of like the Blood Queen, like, you know, the dark fantasy, like the metal thing. It was just seemed really present to me. And I'm like talking about first story arc's going to be Rain and Blood. And then the more I thought about it, I'm like, damn, like there's not even every arc after Slayer album. And I haven't figured quite out like how Slayer Live fits in there, but you know,
You should have told us that offline because we could have used that as one of our next questions.
Oh, shh. You can edit this part.
So I've been wondering, did you name your stuff after Slayer songs?
Yeah, there's a whole royal family within the Blood Queen universe that the members of the family are named after Ronnie James Dio's family. I am not even kidding. Wow. I'm working on the kingdoms and I'm like, okay, here's the kingdoms and here's like the various people that populate the kingdom and like this kingdom of Azimuth, you know, and I'm like, okay, I need some names because, you know, sometimes, you know how this works is sometimes you pull in like names of people you know and sometimes names are references to particular things and I'm like,
right.
damn it, what are Ronnie James Dio's kid's name? It's like just like Wikipedia. Oh, okay. Hey, guess what? I've got a whole royal family. Perfect. There we go. And you know, again, it was like this whole kind of metal thing because we were joking about like the first cover and everything being like so metal. You know, it's like that's one of the best things. Jay Anacleto and Ali Garza doing these covers. I'm like, I look at Anacleto's covers for each issue of Blood Queen, and I'm like, that could have been like a Molly Hatchet album or something. You know, they're like, they're so metal, which entertains me enormously. You know, maybe it's just me. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's almost certainly just me. But that music thing, you know, that really plays into the web comics, you know, the Spark Shooter and Solo Acoustic, just the idea of being able to weave a lot of music references in.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and like we've been talking back and forth about the Hammer movies and all that. It's fun to use your full range of experience and all this stuff that you're interested in and kind of be able to bring it to bear. And those little things that you kind of pick at as like pop culture chestnuts, like, you know, Valpurgisnacht. Being April 30th and that like actually being near the beginning of the Dracula novel, right. Jonathan Harker's making his journey. And mm-hmm. I mentioned that kind of a couple of times about like what date it would be as we were working on it. And I think they just did it on purpose. When the book went live online on Kindle, it was on April 29th.
Nice.
And it was just like, you know, it was one of those things like Santa got my letter. you know, cause I just absolutely, it was just absolutely hilarious to me that like the first full day of release was April 30th was Valpurgisnacht. I just found that enormously satisfying on a certain level that like, you know, two other people would get. That's kind of my, I have a lot of jokes on Spark Shooter that like reference stuff that, you know, they're funny on one level, but like people I know, you know, guys that I grew up with, guys that are, you know, still good friends I went to high school with or whatever, I'll get emails from them. They're like, holy crap, I can't believe you made that joke because it means something completely different to them. You know, it's a regular joke in that respect, but it applies specifically to, you know, like my friend Jason.
Jason got it.
Yeah, Jason got it. You know, Mick Foley was a guy that did that. When he would talk about at length when he was giving his interviews, cutting promos in the ring, you know, he said sometimes it was more important to make four guys in the back laugh. and I totally get that. I'm like, yep, I get it. I see.
So, actually, I was going to say, we're at about 50 minutes now, and, you know, as we're closing out, I found an interesting article. I was doing some searching online today, and it was written by a much younger Troy Brownfield. 10 comics that aren't filmed yet, but that should be.
Nice.
Let's see how good your predictions were.
And actually, it's funny because this is back from February of 2011, and the funny thing is that none of these are movies or have been made movies yet. A couple of them are in the works, but none of them are.
I am awesome.
So, is 1 through 4 Wonder Woman? I mean,
actually, the first one is Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I vaguely remember this. I'm almost certain the Elementals is on the list, but I couldn't tell you from the top of my head. That's one of those things that like those Newsarama, top 10 lists and so forth that, you know, like Mike Duran would say, I need a top 10 list. What do you want? Like top 10 reasons Mike is bothering me today. No. you know, something like, you know, top 10 movies that, you know, haven't been made yet. Okay. I can do that.
I mean, the most important argument you make here is that, you know, she is the most iconic female superhero ever. And yeah. The fact that she hasn't gotten a movie yet is just ridiculous. Yeah. But, you know, apparently they're fixing that soon.
Yeah, and I did love the meme going around about a year ago, the idea of, like, DC says Wonder Woman's so hard, Marvel says here's a raccoon with a machine gun. I mean, there's, you know, and the high comedy of it is you have Joss Whedon, one of the most successful guys around with putting, you know, a female action hero into play.
Yep.
Not just once, but repeatedly, and you can't get that movie made with that guy.
Right.
You're kidding me. You know, and it's, I guess it's better for all of us because then he, you know, he got free to make Avengers, but you know, it's just still that baffles me that didn't happen. And I think that whole thing had already gone on by that point, by the time that I wrote that piece. What else was on there, if I might ask? Because
actually then the next one is Flash. Okay. He's getting a TV series.
Yeah.
Consolation prize.
Again.
and then Teen Titans, which, which is interesting.
That would be great.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we have to introduce a DC cinematic universe, before we can, you know, get Teen Titans, I think.
Well, the thing I liked about Teen Titans initially was you had a lot of that supernatural element in it, which kind of went contrary to the title. It had like a very horror kind of sub-theme to it, you know?
Yeah. There was a lot of good stuff in that. You know, when New Teen Titans was coming out, initially, just how apocalyptic it was.
Yeah.
It was really cool. I mean, that whole idea that Raven had pulled them together and, it was very different tone for that kind of book, especially if you'd read, you know, the previous run at all. Cause I was just old enough to have read the end of the 70s run.
Right. And, right.
Yeah. Speedy left to join a band.
Yeah. And I remember talking to Marv Wolfman one time at a convention and he was just surprised at the stuff that he got away with in Teen Titans, you know, and I think he had commented that at the time, I think the DC editors just, you know, they assumed, hey, the name's Teen Titans, you know, do what you want with the book. We're assuming that you're keeping within the theme of the book. And there was some very adult material there, like in the Judas Contract storyline specifically. Oh.
I remember, just like,
how did you get away with that?
Yeah, I was 10 or 11 when Judas Contract came out, and like the realization that the relationship that Terra and Deathstroke were actually having was a huge shock.
You like start doing the math, you're like, how old is she again?
Yeah. And when they did the Baxter series, the first issue when Raven has a nightmare and wakes up screaming because Trigon's coming back, and they cut to all the Titans waking up, and Dick and Corey were in bed together.
Uh-huh.
They hadn't shown that in comics that I recall. You barely even had the whiff that Scott and Jean were having sex in X-Men. And, you know, and like they literally show that they were cohabiting. And that was 1984?
Yeah, that was early.
that was shocking, you know. Yeah. But yeah, that kind of article, you know, that's kind of like Newsarama's, it's one of those things that you can do and always builds discussion. You know,
I wanted to point something out too. So the next one is Justice League, you know, which they're on their way for Justice League. But what I love in this article, since it was written in 2011.
Oh, no.
Can't wait.
We pretty much know that Bale is out. But Cavill and Reynolds, if GL works.
There was a big if there.
Yes.
Yeah. I had my suspicions.
You could smell it before the movie even came out.
Well, that's one of those great things. Like I mentioned, my kids, Connor, complains about the lack of a GL sequel because they did set up the Sinestro thing at the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, to him, that's kind of offensive that like, and I said, there've been lots of movies that have been set up for sequels that didn't have one. And he's like, come on, you know, they said, well, how about this? How about they should have just started with Sinestro? I said, Connor, they made the Green Lantern movie. It was called Training Day. All they needed to do was just rewrite that with Hal and Sinestro. And it's their fault that they didn't. So that's, you know,
I always joke with my wife, who's a huge Elektra fan and was so let down by the movie that the, so we just call Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2 the Elektra movie now.
I like that. That's a good example.
I think she was crying after we left the theater, if I recall correctly.
So bad. And that was such a blow too, because, you know, Jennifer Garner was, you know, being on Alias at the time, which she was so good at.
And she had the skills to do the actual stunts and the fighting and everything. I mean, you know, you had a perfect actress for it.
It's another case of having a strong female character that you somehow drop the ball on, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they ran away. What's number five? Now, I'm really entertained by this. it's like the Flash number zero where Wally talks to his younger self. It's like, it's all going to be okay.
Well, I'm finding it fascinating. The first four are all DC, which, you know, tells me you were hungry for a good, you know, DC to get on the same playing field as Marvel at the time.
That's where we are. That's everybody. Yeah.
So next you have Bone.
There you go.
Oh,
yeah.
That could be a cool one.
Yeah. Where is the epic Bone animated film or animated series? You know?
Right.
Picture this. I mean, okay, I know they hideously screwed up with the whole Legend of Korra thing, but could you imagine the animation talent behind Avatar and Legend of Korra on a Bone style show?
That would be cool.
I mean, that would be awesome. And kids know Bone because of the Scholastic delivery system, Scholastic book orders. I every once in a while I'll talk at libraries and whatnot about comics and stuff around here and like some of Connor's friends and stuff. And if you say, hey, do you know Bone? Yes, unequivocally. They know the character. Wow. They know the
That's
books.
Surprising.
They're in the libraries. They're in the Scholastic book orders. The Complete Bone is available usually a couple of times a year. A couple of novels they did, like with the stupid rat creatures and stuff, those are available. But, the elementary school that my kids go to, the Bone volumes are all available there. Both local libraries on either side of us have all of them. The kids know who those characters are.
Yes.
They would have a much larger audience than they believe.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So. The next one is probably one of the most acclaimed graphic novels that has no other adaption that I know of, and that's Mouse Guard.
Yeah. Again, same thing.
Yeah.
You consider whether it's the Henson people or the various foreign studios, that's really ripe for being done. I mean, which by the same token, I'm kind of mystified no one's ever taken a stab at Redwall either. Right. Brian Jacques' Redwall series. I mean, it was there might have been an animated series at one point, but I'm not sure. But still, that kind of thing, I don't know.
All right, and then the next one, I'm not familiar. I don't. The title doesn't stick out to me. Maus?
Mouse.
Yeah.
Maus.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Well, again, in an environment where you can make Persepolis.
Right.
I think you could make Mouse. I think you could. And it would be, it'd be difficult. But, I think that you've proven, again, Persepolis being kind of the gold standard on this, that you can do difficult material in an animated context and have it be of value. Similarly, the British studio that made the adaptation of Watership Down and the Plague Dogs,
mm-hmm.
Those are heavy duty concepts, Plague Dogs in particular.
Yeah.
And it still managed to be done with refinement. So.
My mom's like, watch this, it's a cartoon. I'm like, what are you doing to me, mother?
Yeah. Wow. Watership Down had did that too.
Yeah.
It's like, this is just like Charlotte's Web. No.
And Watership Down is one of my favorite books of all time. It's like, that's one of those things that like I've juggled, like, when do I give it to Connor? That kind of thing. Right. It's like, because that kid is a voracious reader and, there's so many things that I want to share with him. At the same time, I'm like, wow, I don't, the depression that will follow. let's balance that out.
Just give him something to perk him up afterwards, like, Lord of the Flies or something.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
No more sea for a month.
I almost made a Smith's joke. Good work. He's got classmates that have read The Hunger Games already. And I'm like, I don't think they're really getting what's going on there.
You said he's 9 now?
Yeah, he's 9. He's got classmates that have read all the Hunger Games novels. And he's like, look, Dad doesn't want me to yet. I'm like, well, son, go ahead, read those. I've got this movie called Battle Royale on the shelf you're not supposed to touch. Come see me when you're done. It's like, that's kind of like the joke. It's like, that's Dad's shelf, Tarantino. And so it is an interesting balancing act, especially when you were a kid. It's like when I was a kid, and I was sneaking my Stephen King books by that point already. And I'm like, I don't know if it's hypocrisy so much as I know what. But yeah, so we were saying, Mouse Guard and then Mouse. I had a theme going.
Yes. And then Invincible.
Yeah. Yeah, and Thief of Thieves is coming, right? Isn't it? Isn't Thief of Thieves being developed for TV by Kirkman? Didn't hear it.
Yes, I did hear something about that.
Yeah, so. I don't know, and I still think that Invincible is doable, but I think that what we kind of know of Invincible now, I think would be kind of hard to batten on to the things that we like about Invincible as a long running book in one
video. Right.
You know,
once they did it as a TV show or something, a weekly.
Yeah. I mean, that there's some potential. Like that's the one thing that kind of, I'm kind of interested in is that FX loves to show the Marvel movies. And they've got a couple of long running shows that are wrapping up, you know, like Sons of Anarchy and so forth. And I'm curious if, it seems to me FX would be the prime spot for a Punisher TV show.
Oh yeah.
You know,
be a great fit.
Fill that Sons of Anarchy void, you know, I mean, you know, that'd be a great spot for it, you know, so I don't know, but, Invincible, I think could work given the proper budget. It's just, part of the charm of that book is the expansive cast. And I don't know that they could get into a cast that big.
Right.
Yeah. I would though, you bring up Punisher. I mean, I understand FX is a cable channel, but can they do a, you know, a true gritty enough Punisher even on a, you know?
I would venture to ask, have you watched Sons of Anarchy?
No, actually I have.
Oh my God. Yes.
They're pretty filthy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They could do, especially that, really strong, late 80s era, you know, where they had Microchip and, you know, there was the Stephen Grant mini, and then was it Stephen Grant that was writing the ongoing? Like, Will Sportaccio and Jim Lee were drawing issues like War Journal and stuff. Like,
Yeah, early on.
Yeah, a lot of that material, I think that would really lend itself well to that kind of show. Cause Sons of Anarchy, is the kind of show that, I think that it peaked as far as being a great drama a couple of seasons back. And now I know a lot of people who watch it because they're like, I just want to see what they do next week.
That's how Smallville stayed on the air for so long.
Yeah.
Well, Smallville at least is like, I want to see what character they do next week. Sons of Anarchy is like, I want to see how far they get before someone tells them no.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
And then the next one on your list is being made into a movie.
Uh-huh.
And that's Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Which is funny because you said, you know, in a world with Thor and Harry Potter, you know, it's definitely something that's doable. I just read an article today. I don't know how true it is. It's the first I've heard of it. And so I still put it in the rumor mill. But Daniel Radcliffe apparently has been in talks with Marvel.
And
people are speculating that he's going to play, Doctor Strange. They said they could forego the origin story because it's Harry Potter just coming in to save the day as Doctor Strange now.
My first impulse is that like Daniel Radcliffe is actually, reading for Cyclops for when they steal the X-Men back from, I don't know. I've heard like three really crazy disparate rumors for Doctor Strange lately. And they were, Radcliffe, Joaquin Phoenix, and John Hamm. A more different trio of guys you could scarcely imagine, I think.
Yeah.
John Hamm, really?
No. I thought Johnny Depp had been thrown out there for a little bit.
That's what the magic's for! Yeah, John Hamm. thanks. I'll be here all week. Tip your wages. Depp, you know, Depp would be cool. Like the Joaquin Phoenix is interesting, but it's like that cat's just too weird. I think that it's just, he'd, you know, maybe a great Baron Mordo or, you know, I mean, I can see him as, you know, I mean, he did the eccentric villain in Gladiator, you know,
that's true.
Do that, but like, and Hamm, I don't know. I really liked the Patrick Dempsey idea. You know, people talked about Patrick Dempsey, as being interested in Doctor Strange, and which I kind of love on a really crazy level. Cause you know, he plays a neurosurgeon on Grey's Anatomy. So he's just one car accident away from making the transition to Doctor Strange, but he started letting his temples go gray too. I think that's like subtle casting. He's working on it. It's like, see, cast guys, me. I'm not vain. I'm
just it's funny. I've heard this theory before. In fact, our one co-host who isn't here tonight again, Ben, has thrown this out there too, that he feels that, and I've heard other people echo this, they float these casting rumors out on purpose to see how the internet reacts. Yeah. And if people are like, oh, that sucks, then, oh, okay, no, that was just a rumor.
Yeah.
That didn't stop Ben Affleck. That was true.
Ben Affleck was, yeah. Donnie, well, did the Affleck joke this time, damn it.
Thanks.
Do you get the sense that I don't know if it's Warner just, is just a very, I don't know, there's a big, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it properly, and it's eluding me.
Trying to kill themselves?
Trying to make sense. Yeah, trying to make sense of it. But they're just kind of like, Warner is shaking their fist and ordering you to like what they do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you will like Ben Affleck as Batman. You know, and they don't take that into account. And
look at that jawline. He'll be great.
Yeah.
Which, you know, maybe it'll be good. But again, you know, this is one of the things where I think the director definitely works against it. I mean, has Ben Affleck been good in dramatic films? Yes. You know, Argo, for example. But, you know, he was directing himself. He's good in The Town. Yeah, it's like he's aware of his range, you know, in a very specific way, and he applies it in specific things. But, you know, Snyder is so weirdly operatic and in a way that I don't think Affleck is. Like, Affleck is best in his stuff where he's grounded.
Right.
You know, Good Will Hunting is a very grounded performance. He didn't direct it, but he wrote it.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
Ben Affleck also gets the honor of being one of the few actors to actually play Batman and Superman, because he did Superman in the George Reeves biopic.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point. Nice.
Hey, just think, it could have been worse. They could have hired Shyamalan.
Oh. And at the end, he's an alien.
Yeah. Wait, what?
That was the big twist in Superman.
Yeah.
An alien until the end.
That's right.
Shot off on Earth and landed on Earth.
The planet
of Earth all along.
It's a planet of mostly water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. Signs, which in retrospect should just be named Size, because that's what we all do when we talk about it.
And last but not least, you had listed Namor, and you have a little note in here that you don't want the Aquaman fans to be upset.
No, Namor's completely different. That could be a really dark film.
Yeah.
I mean, he's hardcore. He could be, he's not, this is not the guy that just, you know, screams at fish.
Yeah. And who's got Namor now? I mean, is it within the framework of all the things? Is Universal have him? He's like the lone.
Yeah, he is the one that's one of them by them himself. I think it's Universal.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I just know he's out there somewhere, which I don't know. That would be, I think I was really thinking about that at the time, because there had been a lot of rumors to the effect that they were trying to get that to happen. But I really like Kevin Feige's kind of deliberate nature with this stuff, when people are really pushing him to, you know, people are on Marvel about making certain films, and he's like, they'll happen as they happen, because, you know, and I like the implied, I'm 10 for 10, bitches. you know, but it's like, why would you jump on the guy to change or rush his process when he's done such a good job so far?
Right.
You know, and that's one of the you know, at this point, I'm like, Age of Ultron, I've heard so much stuff about that excites me, that really the only thing I'm like asking for is like someone to say some version of Avengers Assemble, you know, and like the rest of it, I'm like, okay, good. You know, in fact, I like the idea. This is like Connor and I were having the conversation, because my, you know, again, my 9-year-old, he really wants the Thor, Ultron, we would have words with thee to be in the movie, you know, which I'm like, come on, you know, think about the way that they've done the Marvel movies now. How badass would that be to have Hemsworth deliver the Ultron, we would have words with thee bit? I mean, come on. People would go nuts. Women would spontaneously burst into pregnancy.
Everybody slides off their chair.
Because, yeah. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, I love the idea of, like, because you have that whole thing if they've been talking very deliberately about, you know, the Vision's going to be working for Ultron when it starts. And like, we all know how that song ends. And I love the idea of the Vision being the Darth Vader turn in Return of the Jedi.
Right.
You know, it's like, how about the Vision is the guy that says Avengers Assemble? I love the notion of the, cause he is the thing. He, you know, as Jarvis, he was the apparatus that linked everybody. They didn't come right out and say it, but like the whole idea of like, how are all the characters talking to each other remotely? Well, it's cause Tony's relaying it through Jarvis and talking to everyone. It's like kind of the implied situation. So I like the idea of that. But as far as that goes, that's the only thing I've thought about. I'm like, man, they've got this. They've so got this. Like Guardians of the Galaxy. Could you imagine?
Yeah.
And they did such a good job on that one.
Like, I expected to like it. I just did not expect to be busting a gut for 2 hours of screen time. I mean, and James Gunn, like, was just on a completely different level with some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I swear to God, if I were in high school, I would have already formed my 70s cover band named Pelvic Sorcery. There is no doubt. There is no doubt. There's,
Just real quick, I actually just found an article from July of this year on Cinema Blend, which I didn't see this before. No. Marvel is actually talking with Universal right now about the Namor rights, basically saying they're getting the rights back, but they're still working out all the details. So that was as of July 18th. So perhaps we will see a Namor movie from Marvel in the near future.
Marvel promises that if they get the Namor rights back, that Marvel won't make its Tomb of Dracula movie with the Marvel logo on it.
Perhaps.
Because, you know, come on, wouldn't that be hysterically funny? Like, Universal's all ramped up. We're going to make our Dracula movie, and Marvel's like, middle finger extended, Tomb of Dracula, Dracula versus Blade. There you go.
Does your Dracula movie have Captain America in it?
Yeah. Because ours does. Yeah, I mean, come on. That's, I love that idea of the negotiation, because that whole Daredevil thing was hysterically funny to me. It was like, 20th Century Fox gonna get Daredevil into production. They're gonna get Daredevil. Marvel doesn't seem really interested in pursuing the Marvel wasn't, because they knew that thing was gonna collapse.
Yeah. Right.
Just like, you know, how seriously does anyone really actually take the Fantastic Four movie at this point?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, don't we feel that is just on the precipice daily? I mean, they've been talking about this thing for like 3 years. All respect to the director and some of the cast. Like, yeah, I think Michael B. Jordan would be a really interesting Human Torch. But they've literally been talking about that since like the day after Chronicle came out.
Yeah.
You know,
this is like what, if you watch CinemaSins, CinemaSins Jeremy has a separate channel, and he did a little blurb on this, one of his rants about how this is a case of you have two properties. You've got all the Marvel stuff at Marvel, and then you've got Fantastic Four over here and Spider-Man. And you've got, if you had just a crossover, like if just Spider-Man appeared in the Avengers and one of the Avengers or two of them appeared in the Spider-Man, both properties would make so much money. It would be incredible. And they're not going to do it because neither one is, they just won't, because they're just too stupid to, you know.
Yeah. Well,
there's just money laying there waiting for them to pick it up.
I have the feeling that Sony is about to drive the Spider-Man stuff off a bridge, quite frankly. And, you know, it's just maybe they'll pull it out, but it seems like they were really high on the Sinister Six movie until Amazing 2 came out, and then they backed way off of that. Yeah. And now it's like, we're going to do a female movie. We're going to do a female teen movie. They don't even know what they're doing. They're literally just like, they're kind of doing what you said. They're floating the balloons. They're just throwing ideas at the wall. And people are going to get excited, and they'll chatter about it, and they'll tweet about it and stuff, right up until Marvel says, so the unannounced movie for 2017 is Black Panther. And everyone's going to go, what? You know, and then no one will care.
Yeah.
And it will just – and so, you know, and what you said, you know, if Marvel wanted to tomorrow, they could call Andrew Garfield and put him in an uncredited cameo just as himself.
Yes.
In Age of Ultron. In fact, we were, one of my friends and I were joking about that. The, Andrew Garfield and Hugh Jackman rescue a civilian from a car scene in Age of Ultron. so that you could have the Avengers, you could have the X-Men and Spider-Man crossover. You know, just like the joke of that kind of thing. because Marvel has all of the power in this situation. And I think that they won't do the Avengers Spider-Man crossover overtly because they don't want to help Sony.
Well, that goes back to, didn't they, Dave, weren't we talking about him not allowing toys for those lines or something?
Yeah, the X-Men, they're not merchandising Fantastic Four in particular.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And,
kind of a socket to them kind of thing.
Yeah. They did do, there's a promotion right now at Walmart that happened with Amazing Spider-Man 2 of, they have 4 trade paperbacks for $5 each. And they're actual full trade paperbacks. Some of them cost $15 to $21 in the comic shop. Now what they've done, they printed them on like a one level down paper stock.
Okay.
But it's the first 3 issues and bonus material of the current Guardians of the Galaxy run for $5. The first volume of Captain America the Winter Soldier, Spider-Man Big Time, and the first few issues of Avengers, the Bendis John Romita Jr. run. Each of those trades is $5, and they have them racked with the Amazing Spider-Man 2 DVDs, like in a separate cardboard bin. Okay. Here's the thing that's interesting. They included Spider-Man in that promotion, Marvel did, because I mean, it ties into the Amazing release and then Winter Soldier coming up here in a couple weeks, but there's no X-Men trade.
Mm-hmm.
There's no FF trade. They're like, you know, Cap, because the Cap movie's coming out, Spidey, because the Spidey movie's coming out, Guardians, because Guardians is out, and Avengers, because it's the marquee. You know, I think that tells you all you need to know about Marvel's priorities right now.
Right.
It's just like, they could, you know, they are not interested in driving those other things. Like, the X-Men comics are always going to be there. You know, those will survive on their own, because they have, you know, for so long. Like, they don't have to do any extra promotion for that. That's going to stick around.
Mm.
FF? Marvel's canceled FF before.
Yes.
More than once. I don't think it's gonna hurt them in the long term. I think that there's probably a segment of people out there that, like the movie going public, that it might start rejecting things like the FF because they don't tie into the other Marvel films, which is a weird thing for the cinema going public to get into.
Right.
But, you know, I kind of get that sense. It's like, I've got cousins who are really into the Marvel movies. They don't read the comics. They could care less, frankly, you know? But man, they're really into the movies. And if the Fantastic Four movie was coming out, I guarantee, like, one of them would be asking me, you know, does this go with the others? I'd be like, nope. And they're like, okay, well then I don't need to see it.
Just tell them that, the Fantastic Four is always off planet on vacation when something happens in downtown.
you just hit my sore spot because, like, yeah, that should be what the FF is doing. And that all they've talked about incessantly is we've got to ground it.
Yeah.
It's got to be grounded in reality. Yes. Because a property where you have a doorway to the negative zone in the coffee room should be grounded in reality. Yes. It's like, where's Franklin? Oh, he bounced his ball into the negative zone. We've got to go get him and fight Blastar and discover.
I said it was the third door on the left.
That's right.
No.
Order of Fulton Development, this is. You know, yeah, I mean.
I actually think that's a interesting line in the sand between Marvel. I think Fox is kind of on the same side as Marvel. And then Sony. Well, no, because Fox is doing Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
So maybe not. It depends on the director, but DC seems to be on that boat too, where it's like, well, Marvel's more like, no, let's just have fun, do a good movie and have fun with it. And who cares about how grounded in reality it is? And DC and Fox are like, no, it's got to be grounded in reality because that's what moviegoers want. No, it's not.
Yeah. Well, again, DC faces the proposition of, of running screaming into the fact that all roads lead to Darkseid. And yeah. By the time they eventually get there, moviegoers will say, that's just Thanos, which is hilarious for all kinds of reasons.
Yes.
You know, but that, you know, no one's told them that yet.
Right.
You know, no one, they're going to get up to that and they're going to be like, okay, now here's the big crap. You know, yeah, cause they've got, where do you go? Like, the ultimate extension for that is always Darkseid. Yeah. It happened in the Justice League cartoon. Young Justice was headed there.
Yep.
You know, I mean, which was kind of my big complaint about the new 52 first arc. Okay, not my big complaint. A complaint of many. But, you know, you shot your wad on the first arc.
Yes.
I was like, okay, so they come together, they fight Darkseid, and they skip ahead or ahead 5 years later, because you know that nobody in the intervening 5 years was as interesting as fighting Darkseid. right. So, you know, you're kind of like, you kind of stuck with that. I mean, you know, I think most people recognize that superhero titles, from a writing perspective, are a series of crests and falls, mm-hmm. and that you have to, you build to your apex, and then it's like after that, you know, to the point where, like, even when the Legion of Superheroes fought Darkseid, like, the next issue or two afterwards was called What Do You Do the Day After Doomsday? it's one of those things where it's like, okay, how do we level up? And, you know, there are some people that, that missed this, like when Avengers came out, they're like, ah, oh, they just end up fighting a bunch of alien soldiers and then Loki. I'm like, well, of course, that's perfect because, you know, next time it's going to be so much bigger because yeah. that's what we're trained to expect, that right. it gets so but, much bigger, which is why the heroes end up fighting themselves a lot.
But look what happened with Smallville. I mean, Smallville, they built up 10 years to fighting the dark side and then he just pushed the planet away in like 5 seconds. It was done.
Or even just look at Man of Steel. I mean, look at how big they started with Man of Steel.
Yeah.
You know, where do they go from there?
You have the planetary threat. Well, you know, Man of Steel is backed into a corner by the fact that you had, you know, basically 5 previous Superman films that only one of them had featured antagonists really on Superman's level. You had 3 that featured Lex Luthor as a villain, 1 that featured Napoleon Solo as a Lex Luthor stand-in, mm-hmm. and then you had the one with the 3 Kryptonian criminals. Like, you're arguing that a guy in a suit is Superman's match in all of those movies, which kind of boxes Superman in. Right. So when they finally get to the point, it's like, we're going to have a real big villain, we're going to cut loose, we're going to have this planet-wide destruction that you kind of, like, blew it out again in the first issue.
They're going to bring Thanos in. Yeah,
he has a kryptonite gem in his gauntlet. Did anyone else think that, like, when Lex Luthor started sporting the gauntlet with all the different pieces of kryptonite?
It's yeah.
like,
yeah,
Infinity Gauntlet. Crisis on Infinity Gauntlet. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, that's go back to my 9-year-old for a minute. Connor is absolutely convinced that Avengers 3 won't be Thanos. He's convinced that there will be an Avengers 3, which leads into the Infinity Gauntlet movie, which has everybody in it.
Yeah.
That's like his 9-year-old fan conception. He's like, there'll be a special episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And then, you know.
Normally I'd say that's impossible, that could never get past it. Something that awesome could not get past a bunch of substance snorting execs. But Marvel has handled this so well that actually might be a possibility.
We're going to do one more movie. It's called Infinity Gauntlet. Who's in it? Everybody. Is Downey in it? Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah.
Well, if they kept with the Infinity Gauntlet storyline, wouldn't it be everybody minus half?
Yeah. That's how you save money on the salaries. Yeah. That's how you do the overhead. It's like, you know, it's like we're going to shoot them both simultaneously, but most of the people, they only have to be there like 2 days. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Is Hemsworth in? Hemsworth isn't. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Like you get, literally, you know, that, I mean, we joke about it, but those things are eminently possible. We exist in a realm of that kind of thing being possible.
What a time to be alive.
Yes. Seriously.
Yes. It's weird. Yeah, we got way off the field, which
yes,
is cool.
Yes.
The conversation is it's a good one. This is fun. I think we're talking about, like, these are the things that the people who invest in the stuff, both with their time and their money, they think about these things, you know, because they enjoy it. You know, it's, you know, I make the joke, like, I live in Indiana, right? And you drive around the neighborhood and, like, if garage doors are up, you see a lot of, like, NASCAR flags hanging in garages.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, I've always been the mutant to those guys, but, you know, I also feel like the Omega Man in reverse, you know, yeah, cause it's, but it's like when we fellow, you know, Omega Men get together, Charlton Heston, Will Smith, you know, we also invest in these kinds of things in time and interest, because this is what we follow. This is what we talk about. And I think it's cool when we all get together and get to have these kinds of conversations, because sometimes in isolation, when you're just writing and stuff, you know, you don't get to talk to people about it.
Yeah.
Because you're focused on doing the job, and like, you know, one artist is in the Philippines and one is in Spain, and you're really just kind of doing the thing. You don't, I think that's one of the reasons why so many creators really, really do enjoy the conventions, because they just get together and talk with people who really like the stuff on the same level that they do.
How wow, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yes. And Troy Brownfield, you are legend.
Thank you.
And I always recommend for people who've never read that, the actual short story, I Am Legend, yeah. They should read it and see how different it is than any adaptation you've ever seen.
Yeah, it's glorious. It's math. If you've never read Richard Matheson to any extent, oh my God, please do. Please.
I love I Am Legend. Yeah. Actually, the closest adaptation, I think, is Vincent Price's Last Man on Earth is like the closest one I've seen to an actual novel.
Yeah, absolutely. And The Incredible Shrinking Man, you know, it had the movie representation, but damn, that book, you know, I Still Exist, you know, it's just, some of that stuff just sticks with you. I mean, you know, I don't know where the fantastic short story, I mean, Harlan Ellison still manages to crank some stuff out here and there, but, and Stephen King does some great stuff. Christopher Golden, some of these guys that work on the anthologies for Del Rey and St. Martin's, you know, you see some great short stories here and there, but the trend in fantasy and science fiction has drifted toward the epic, the super huge book.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss some of these great short stories that I kind of grew up with that, I mean, I'm sure some are out there. I'm sure people will send me angry emails. That tends to happen. One time, I recently remarked on that there hadn't been a lot of comic conventions in Indiana a long time, and I got this several diatribes on Twitter about like the local Star Trek convention, and I'm like, which is the Star Trek convention, which wasn't the comic convention, which I was, yeah. So I got, yeah. They set their phasers on Belittle, and
yes. So I would say to all the fans listening, make sure you send all your angry email to Troy.
Troy does. That's at Troy Brownfield on Twitter.
So I think, you know, this is a good place to wrap it up at. So everyone listening, make sure you check out Blood Queen and Prince Dracula. You can
I'm excited for Prince Dracula. I want to check
that out on Amazon. I actually purchased it while we were talking, and I'm going to go start reading it tomorrow.
You can keep track of most of what I'm doing, like I mentioned on Twitter, but all the webcomics I do on sparkshooter.com. That's a pretty good place to keep tabs on everything that's going on with various places. So.
Yes, and people can find you on the Twitters.
Yes.
The Twitters.
The Twitters.
It's a series of tubes. at Troy Brownfield, yes.
All right. Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, as always, don't let your cake get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Have a good night, guys.
You too.
Speaking of capes, you can tug on ours by joining the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+ at Superhero Speak. If you have any comments on my bad jokes, you can email me at dave@superheroespeak.com.
You can also subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, and various other channels. Or if you'd like to tease the beard of knowledge, you can email me at ben@superheroespeak.com.
We also occasionally rant about things on our website, superheroespeak.com. Or if you'd like to further discuss the prowess of Rainbow Dash versus anybody in the greater geek universe, you can email me at john@superheroespeak.com.
Now let go of our cape.